Good morning. We are in, making sure you're in the right place, section 216, Faith is a Deadly Sin of Pride. We have a presenter who is not here yet. Dr. Glenn Cornett is a principal of Pastoris Pharma, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, a clinical stage biotechnical company focused on the disorders of the central nervous system, and apparently he is an accomplished musician and composer too, so I am impressed on multiple scale. And our respondent?
Kim McCall
holds a bachelor's in philosophy and an MS in computer science. What an interesting combination. Both from Stanford University. And he, too, is loving singing, dancing, and as he calls his awesome ward choir. I will not read the abstract because I assume you read it in order to be interested enough to come here. So I won't take that time, but I do want to point out just three-fourths of one sentence in it. And it says that this paper discusses unflinching and uncritical faith as a sin of pride. And as I was saying as we were up here, that reminded me of a whole lot of people I know. And it also reminded me of somebody I knew who came home from a mission, and we all got together for a party, and he sat back and he said, "No, I don't care if I'm ever famous or rich, as long as I remain as humble as I am now." And in 40-some years, I hate to give away my age, I have never forgotten that every time I see the guy. And with that, we're going to have Kim start the paper, and if then Dr. Cornett comes in, we'll have him pick up where Kim stops. And I cannot resist, oh, thank you. Don't grab that. I cannot resist the most cliched introduction. I take great pride in introducing Kim McCall.
Thanks. So Glenn is a very good friend of mine. And I take great pride in representing him here. So I'm just going to start reading here. He has a slide presentation, which I think will help once it gets here. But let me just start by reading. Let me start by saying this paper has been in part an exercise for me to articulate why I think faith can be important and beneficial despite its destructive potential. The paper, therefore, endeavors to cover quite a bit of ground in a short amount of time. I already warned you about that. This is a work in process that I hope to refine further in the coming months. Your candid comments and suggestions will be appreciated. Imagine a quote from President Benson. Those of you who go to church a bunch have seen President Benson's talk on the mortal sin of pride, something like that, I think it was called. In his oft-referenced April 1989 General Conference address entitled Beware of Pride, there we go, then-President Ezra Taft Benson said, "Pride is the great stumbling block to Zion." I repeat, pride is the great stumbling block to Zion. I am here to agree emphatically with that statement, taking Zion to mean the mainstream LDS culture. Mm-hmm. So he has interpreted, I'm going to editorialize, the great stumbling block to Zion meaning a great problem within Zion, okay? Taking Zion to mean the church as it currently exists, the mainstream culture, and pride being a stumbling block within there. I think that's a misinterpretation of what President Benson actually said. He meant in our way to get to Zion, one of the greatest stumbling blocks in that path is our pride, which that's my way. But this is, Glenn is saying, within the Zion culture, within the LDS culture, pride is a great stumbling block. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines pride as inordinate self-esteem. A more detailed definition is given elsewhere as a high or inordinate opinion of one's own dignity, importance, merit, or superiority, whether as cherished in the mind or as displayed in bearing, conduct, etc. The pride of which I speak is an inordinately high opinion of the strength of one's own religious views, a certainty that one has already arrived at the correct position, either by birth into or conversion to a particular faith, and that one need not subject the underlying rationale of his position to rigorous considerations of evidence and argument. This perspective is often referred to as faith. This paper takes the position that faith, particularly blind, uncritical faith, can be a sin of pride, if the term sin is taken to mean making an error in moral judgment. Crucial concept here. Going back to earlier religious leaders, we find a list of seven deadly sins, the final or near final form being established by Pope Gregory as, he gives them here in Latin, but I'll give them to you in English, lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, which is a bad translation of asedia, wrath, envy, and number seven, pride, superbia. The Latin word for pride, superbia, sounds altogether too much like suburbia, but perhaps that is best left to more lengthy exegesis. With the above in mind, this paper suggests that uncritical faith can be figuratively, and at times literally, a deadly sin of pride, where one claims that his thoughts or beliefs are sanctioned by his religion and are therefore no longer subject to further scrutiny. 19th century poet Richard Francis Burton claimed to translate a Sufi work called the Qasida. It is evident that Burton instead authored the text. Perhaps its most quoted passage is, "All faith is false, all faith is true. Truth is the shattered mirror strewn in myriad bits, while each believes his little bit the whole to own." Perhaps stated differently, this could be said, having ostensibly actionable insights does not give one license to expound universal truths and expect others to fall in line thoughtlessly, even if there is a claim of revealed truth. I'm not disparaging faith or trust in the broader sense as a sin of pride, the sort of hopeful, optimistic faith that leads one to believe in making oneself more impactful, one's associates happier, or the world better can be a powerful force for good. If one's beliefs lead to principally to improvement of self or others, it is difficult to dismiss outright those beliefs as uniformly destructive. Core beliefs, however, are most robust when they continue to be re-examined and, as appropriate, modified when contrary evidence comes to light. Furthermore, risk tolerance, that is, belief that risks can be worth taking in an ambiguous context in order to achieve an ambitious goal, has historically been a competitive strength in the U.S. and in Silicon Valley in particular. Also, that's where Glenn spends a bunch of his time. Also, trust of others, while opening up at times to deception, disappointment, and loss, is an important basis of social and economic progress. The political economist Francis Fukuyama, in his book titled Trust, states that one of the most important lessons we can learn from an examination of economic life is that a nation's well-being, as well as its ability to compete, is conditioned by a single, pervasive cultural characteristic, the level of trust inherent in the society. Belief, religious or otherwise, however, can easily become destructive when used as a counterargument to reason and evidence. This is because that belief can then be used as a basis for making bad decisions, despite the fact that one had a clear opportunity to make better decisions based on the resources at hand. I would call this sort of faith destructive faith. This destructive faith compromises one's ability to achieve their human potential. This paper will discuss destructive faith first as a tribalist manifestation. We'll focus more specifically on religion, finally examining destructive faith in the context of the LDS community. We'll conclude with some suggestions for balancing the favorable potential of faith with what I suggest is the moral necessity for continuing examination. Tribalism. Let us first discuss tribal aspects of destructive faith. Tribalism, at times virtually synonymous with parochialism, puts undue emphasis upon one's own community or kind. This has the potential to cause passive or active harm to those outside one's group. Tribalism tends to give short shrift to those outside one's group, be that a group based on religion, nationality, ethnicity, or other systematic grouping of individuals. Tribalistic faith, in its destructive forms, can involve believing that one's group is in question, has already provided certain answers that no longer need to be subjected to the rigors of logic or evidence, nor to considerations of universal human dignity. Extreme examples of destructive parochial or tribalistic faith include the ethnic eradications perpetuated by Israel in the Old Testament, which many historians now believe did not actually happen, and the 20th century genocides of World War II, Cambodia, and the Balkans, which very clearly did happen. Lesser examples can include government blockage of internet traffic, national manipulation of currencies, or conduct of state-sponsored industrial espionage, All of these can be distinctly destructive. All of these can be done with the underlying premise that a particular tribe or institution has sanctioned such activity, and that one need think no further. These operationalizations of destructive faith can at times also be termed destructive obedience. Destructive obedience was also a phrase used by Yale researcher Stanley Milgram to describe tribalistic or institutionalist behavior where an agentic shift occurs from a focus on the content or rationale of one's actions, one's own actions, to a focus on the authority of a person or institution prescribing one's actions. So, agentic shift, switching the agent in charge of one's decisions. He or she has, in the course of moving from a biological creature to a civilized person, internalized the basic rules of social life. And the most basic, this is a quote from Stanley Milgram, and the most basic of these is respect for authority. There is an internalized basis for his or her obedience, not merely an external one. The most far-reaching consequences of the agentic shift is that a man or woman feels responsible to the authority directing him or her, but feels no responsibility for the content of the actions that the authority prescribes. Morality does not disappear, but acquires a radically different focus. The subordinate person feels shame or pride depending on how adequately he or she has performed the actions called for by the authority. End of quote. Such an agentic shift, where one endeavors to abdicate responsibility for his or her moral reasoning and transfer it to an institution, tribe, or system of thought, is a central consideration of this paper. This agentic shift rides upon the assumption that the authority one is referencing has been chosen correctly and bears no further material examination. This agentic shift becomes a sin of pride when it leads to errors in moral judgment. So what is the opposite of tribalism? I had for years wondered what a good antonym would be until I found a book titled Cosmopolitanism. From reading the spine, I wondered if this were a flimsy term. Closer examination revealed that the book's author, Kwame Anthony Appiah, is the Rockefeller Professor of Philosophy at Princeton. In case you don't know, that's like the top teaching position in philosophy in the United States. And does work on probabilistic semantics, so I decided to give the word a fair chance. I have since been pleased with the word, the idea, and the book itself. The author states there are two strands that intertwine the notion of cosmopolitanism. One is the idea that we have obligations to others, obligations that stretch beyond those to whom we are related by the ties of kith and kind, and even more formal ties of a shared citizenship. The other is that we take seriously the value not just of human life, but of particular human lives, which means taking an interest in the practices and beliefs that lend them significance. There will be times when these two ideals, universal concern and respect for legitimate differences, clash. There is a sense in which cosmopolitanism is the name, not of the solution, but of the challenge. So, a principal challenge in answering the pitfalls of tribalism is that of striking a balance between universal values and legitimate differences among communities. Of course, some of the legitimate differences among communities can play out as particular strengths. Distinctive communities can provide specific skill sets to their members, they can put concentrated support behind their most promising individuals, and they can provide higher than normal levels of assistance to their less fortunate members. Perhaps the single greatest cultural clash playing out on the national stage in the U.S. is that between fundamentalists, who take the Bible literally or nearly so, and others. In this case, the pride lies in believing one's book and one's interpretation thereof is better than someone else's and is above questioning. Let us now look to the more specific case of faith as a destructive force in the context of religion. Let me start by not dismissing faith and religion wholesale as evil and destructive. It's easy to point to religion as a particular source of institutional abuse and massive human tragedy. Some might even point to religion as the chief source of massive human suffering. Statistics, however, suggest otherwise. At least in the 20th century, which witnessed World War II, the largest scale slaughter in human history. Numbers indicate that nationalist or ethnically driven violence has been responsible for most of the large-scale fatal violence in recent history. Estimates will vary, but the largest scale slaughters of the past century have been, in rough if not exact order, the Second World War with over 50 million deaths, Mao Zedong's regime causing about 40 million, Stalin's Soviet Union coming in at about 20 million, and World War I at about 15 million. None of these were perpetrated, by a church, nor by a leader citing religious reasons as a principal motivation. Instead, we are looking at, in order, fascists, to be precise, allied with communists at the beginning of World War II, communists and more communists, followed by various forms of nationalism. Even in earlier periods of history, when Christianity was wreaking havoc in manifestations such as the Spanish Inquisition, the Christian church served at times as an important counterbalance to other authoritarian structures. I remember one time back in school in Ann Arbor, when I flippantly said to an art history grad student that the Catholic Church had kept the Dark Ages dark. I was immediately informed, in somewhat scalding terms, that the church had instead played a vital role in preservation and progress of civilization, including, of course, the production of many major works of art. More recently, I read, quote, A World Lit Only by Fire, unquote, a book on the Enlightenment by William Manchester, himself no fan of religion. Even Manchester stated that There had been little science and no modern civilization in the Dark Ages, when acceptance of papal supremacy by all Christendom had rescued a continent from chaos. Faith had literally held Europe together then, giving hope to men who had been without it. The most callous despots of the time, fearing God's wrath, had yielded to papal commands, permitting the church to intervene when princes had been devouring one another, forcing them to submit to the argument that temporal rulers must yield to the one authority whose sacraments promised eternal salvation. We have a newly arrived visitor. As a side note, I had the privilege of meeting William Manchester briefly when he spoke at BYU's Marriott Center. This was shortly after publication of his General MacArthur biography titled American Caesar, which a few years later was the name of an Iggy Pop album. Glenn is both a great musician and a fan of serious history of rock and roll. Did you want to do anything with your slides? During his speech, Manchester referenced Anton Chekhov as saying, critics are like flies. They sting, but they don't help with the plowing. Manchester went on, mentioning he preferred to say that critics are like eunuchs. They see it go on in the harem every night, but they can't do it themselves. This insight was greeted by several thousand strong audience almost with silence. You did slightly better. Due to shock or lack of comprehension, I could not tell. Punctuated by about three distinct groans. But I digress. The church's role as a counterbalance to other authoritarian structures, of course, does not mean that the church was or ever has been a unilateral proponent and protector of civilized progress. We're talking about the church in general terms, right?
Yes.
It does, however, suggest one allow that there can be favorable qualities of religion and faith. Nicholas Wade, who was deputy editor of the journal Nature, the scientific journal Nature, prior to becoming a reporter at the New York Times, did an eloquent job of examining both sides of the proverbial coin, applying perspectives of social evolution in a book published in 2009. The volume is titled The Faith Instinct, How Religion Evolved and Why It Endures. There is a slide. The book, while it should appeal to most readers willing to be thoughtful and weigh evidence new to them, perhaps does best at preaching to the somewhat disconverted choir, those who have had favorable experiences with religion and or religious communities, but no longer look at religion as a sole or perhaps even principal source of hypotheses, insights, or truth. Mr. Wade describes religion's evolutionary and social roles. While religion appears to be solely an enterprise of the human species, certain aspects of morality have been clearly demonstrated in other species. For instance, Frans de Waal, great Dutch name, characterizes four building blocks of moral intuition demonstrably present in chimpanzees and monkeys: conflict resolution, empathy, learning of social rules, and reciprocity. So,
I'm not sure if the
thing's working.
Fine.
So that was where conflict resolution, empathy, learning of social rules, and reciprocity.
There's a box in the corner. Maybe
the chimps do these things.
Yes.
Mr. Wade builds upon these findings from non-human primates. Quote, morality is at the heart of our social behavior. Evolution seems to have inscribed not just the capacity for learning the moral rules of one's community, but a significant part of the content. Many moral rules are universal and therefore likely to have a genetic origin. Unquote. Faith and religion, then, have provided a framework for applying these moral rules, with Mr. Wade saying, religion expresses a society's collective wisdom, past and present, as to how its members should best behave in order to enhance the society's survival. During the 50,000 years since modern humans left the ancestral homeland in Northeast Africa, religion has guided people's actions at almost every turn. In archaic states ruled by priest kings, religion and government were inseparable. The church played a leading role in the politics of the later Roman Empire. It preserved Western civilization through the Dark Ages and was in the forefront of European politics until the 17th century and beyond. Unquote. Author, political scientist, and Stanford professor Francis Fukuyama has a forthcoming book titled The Origins of Political Culture. In discussing his work on the book recently with the New York Times, Professor Fukuyama explicitly states, the rule of law comes out of organized religion. This attributes a critical aspect of modernity to Christianity.
I'll apologize later. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Nicholas Wade further describes how the relevance of religion has been materially challenged for the greater population only recently. Only in the last 350 years or so, or the last 0.7% of modern human existence, has the strength of religion started to falter. The dethronement of religion has been a necessary consequence of modernity. Religious leaders, being no better than other kinds, sometimes use their powers to persecute dissidents and stifle inquiry. I'm sure this is completely unfamiliar to all of you in the audience. But it happens elsewhere. Western nations could not function were not church and state separate. Theocratic regimes such as those of Iran seem seriously out of place in the modern world. A central problem facing the three monotheisms, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, has arisen from their claims to historicity. Modern archaeology has provided substantial evidence that there was no exodus from Egypt and no conquest of the Promised Land. The Israelites had always lived in Canaan. The great patriarchs of Israel belonged to legend, not to history. Jesus was a historical figure, but an Orthodox Jew who thought to reform Judaism, not found a new religion. As for Muhammad, there is a strange paucity of independent historical evidence about his life. Some scholars doubt whether he lived in Hijaz, where Islamic texts locate him, and if you wonder if he lived at all. But in other ways, the assertions of historicity present a problem because they make it much harder for each of the monotheisms to adapt to changing times and needs. The fixed texts of Christianity and Islam have made both religions hard to update. In the long run, it would seem that both religions need to adapt to new knowledge or be undermined by it. Let me repeat this last point, as it is critical to the issue of pride. Religions need to adapt to new knowledge or be undermined by it. Matthew 16:4 tells us that a wicked and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign. This, I suppose, causes some to discount tangible evidence in their religious lives and others to be actively against the thoughtful application of empirical evidence in any matters that contradict their beliefs. Organic evolution comes to mind. The prog refusal to admit that one's religious faith might be wrong, however, leads to an inability to benefit from synthesis of new ideas, evidence, and arguments. This leads to an inability to adapt, to participate in and assist with the progress of oneself, one's fellow beings, and of human dignity itself. This stifling of development, this missed humanitarian opportunity, is a sin of pride that finds its basis in destructive adherence to insufficiently examined religious faith. The last major section for conclusions, faith as a stumbling block to the LDS community. Let us now turn our attention to the LDS faith and community. Revisiting Ezra Taft Benson's remark, I am agreeing that pride is the great stumbling block to Zion. That pride with which I am concerned, however, takes the form of a faith that considers itself above scrutiny and beyond considerations of evidence and civil discourse. This sort of pride is captured nicely in the phrase, when the brethren speak, the thinking has been done. This contrasts markedly with the value stressed when I started at a strategic consulting firm fresh out of school. Okay, it was after a couple graduate degrees, so the term fresh might not apply so well. One of the explicit guidelines was to uphold the obligation to dissent. Even junior associates were told
turned over, maybe.
What? Brilliant. Kim is very environmentally conscious. Even junior associates were told to voice their dissenting opinions if they were backed by robust reasoning. This led to better solutions to complex problems, which is, of course, what the clients expected and were paying for. I recall some of my own episodes of extreme LDS confidence, which I'm afraid I had in flagrant overabundance. One was in 7th grade history class when I first heard the idea that Native Americans had come from Asia across the land bridge between what is now known as Siberia and Alaska. I dutifully answered in homework and on tests that Native Americans had come from Israel. My answer was given despite the fact that there evidently was sufficient evidence to posit the land bridge as fact and in the canonical textbooks of the time. I realize now that there were ideas such as the limited geography hypothesis that explained how most Native Americans could be descendants of peoples not in the Book of Mormon, but I was not aware of such views then. I remember being a bit shaken about a decade later, shortly after my return from Thailand. I recounted from someone from South America who looked to me very much like someone from Thailand. I asked her if she was from Thailand, and she sort of giggled and said she was from South America, and that it was funny how I could be so confused. This was someone, given her home country, whom I would have, as a matter of faith, believed to be a descendant of Book of Mormon people. That land bridge hypothesis seemed more credible, but I continued to reject it on grounds of faith. I suppose I did not fully accept the land bridge view until encountering the relevant systematic genetic data, which supported it overwhelmingly. This was long after I finished graduate school. I also remember singing in the choir of a couple of Saturday's Warrior productions as a teenager. I remember the strong emotional appeal of the argument that I and my peers were chosen ones, foreordained to be exposed to and choose the best church on the planet at the best time for the planet. Clearly, this was something to be obediently celebrated forthwith rather than rigorously examined further. Oh, well. The pride that puts itself above reason and balanced inquiry is also reflected in a general conference talk given about 15 years ago by Gordon B. Hinckley. Certitude, which I define as complete and total assurance, is not the enemy of religion. It is of its very essence. Without certitude on the part of believers, a religious cause becomes soft, without muscle, without the driving force that would broaden its influence and capture the hearts and affections of men and women. Here, President Hinckley is almost flat out admitting that religion cannot compete successfully in the free market of ideas and experience. I doubt that was the speaker's intention. It gave me pause when I saw the address on screen during simulcast. It now gives more than pause. I now expect any institution to earn my trust on the basis of reason and evidence. Confidence can be very important, but preferably after one has made a robustly defensible decision. Be strong, be wrong appeals less and less with each passing year as a procedural algorithm for the conduct of life. Nowadays, it seems fair to me to expect at least the same strength of argument from my church, say for limiting the power of women or the rights of the gay community, that I expect from my children, say for putting off homework for another day. Even my youngest child compares favorably in this context. For instance, shortly before I started writing this paragraph, she agreed to return to her homework. I decided at the ripe age of 6 to convert from being a Baptist to being a Mormon. At the time, I was the youngest of 3 children and the only member of my immediate family attending church. I sincerely cared about religion and about philosophy in general. I suppose, though, I at the time was not very familiar with Hegel, Hume, nor Heidegger. I listened to the missionaries and was sincerely engaged by their message of a guide who did not send African children to hell for not knowing, and therefore not believing in, Jesus. It was clear to me that Mormonism, though not as common, provided doctrines that made more sense. Well enough. As impressive and convenient as it would be for me to have chosen a perfect system of thought when I was 6 years old, however, I now take the position that it would be a sin of pride for me to say that I know my decision at age 6 was perfect and needs no further examination. It would also be a sin of pride to say that the group I chose at age 6, even if not perfect, is so much better than its putative competitors, ecclesiastic or secular, that it deserves my unquestioning faith. Perhaps it would also be a sin of sloth, come to think of it. That makes not one, but 2 deadly sins of unquestioning faith. Not looking too good, is it? So reflections, some final thoughts here. Mormon certainty is both celebrated and satirized widely. The ability for LDS adherents to mobilize and execute challenging programs has been widely lauded in cases such as provision of disaster relief after Hurricane Katrina. The same capabilities have received strongly mixed responses when applied to passage of California's Proposition 8 against same-sex marriage and to defeat of the Equal Rights Amendment. Satire of LDS certainty is easy enough to find in South Park, the Book of Mormon musical currently being presented on Broadway, and so forth. Of course, Polk's highly tentative approaches to religion are also out there, such as, what do you get when you cross a 20-year-old Mormon and a 40-year-old Unitarian? Someone who knocks on your door, but is not quite sure why. I stole that someone from a Garrison Keillor routine. He's awesome. In my opinion, the prideful approach of the church and its mainstream culture to marginalization of independent, honest discussion has taken a heavy toll. Mormon certitude continues to polarize. It tends to short the true believers and alienate many of the independently minded. More than half of my closer friends of LDS background are no longer fully engaged in the church. The intellectual landscape of the church has changed to the point that I do not look forward to attending a gospel doctrine class, even in Palo Alto.
Unless I'm teaching.
Well, that's different. It's not an ordinary event, then. Okay. Toward the end of his Beware of Pride talk, President Benson said the following, "Let us choose to be humble. We can do it. I know we can. I am again increasing emphatically here. We should be humble to the point of questioning our current beliefs and our earlier decisions to believe a certain way. This will allow for a community where people can effectively teach one another words of wisdom as well as engage more effectively with the rest of humanity." Plato, in his Apology dialogue, has Socrates saying that the unexamined life is not worth it. It comes to mind that the unexamined faith is of dubious value as well. Personally, I have found my beliefs, such as they are, to be no longer orthodox nor mainstream. I still attend church on occasion. This allows me to make non-Mormons nervous. I still tend to avoid alcohol, coffee, or caffeinated tea. This allows me to make normal non-Mormons nervous. Thank you for your time. I look forward to response and questions.
Let me make a meta comment. Charles Duffy said something really interesting yesterday in one of the sessions. He talked about the importance to everybody of a conversational context, a universe of discourse in which they can feel comfortable, and that there are a lot of people who seek out communities where the conversation around them will make them feel comfortable in their current beliefs. And, you know, Mormons do that at church. And then he said, and if you look around this room, everybody is here because they want to hear things that validate their form of experience. And I have felt that extremely powerful over the many years I've been coming to Sunstone, to the value of being around people who make my way of thinking, who legitimize to me my way of thinking, make me feel comfortable in asking the questions I ask, feeling the feelings I have. I don't want to completely play into that. I feel like part of it, I hope that we won't just be going rah-rah, but that we'll be examining examining ourselves as well as just trying to make ourselves feel good. So I will have a couple of criticisms of the paper toward the end of what I have to say. But first I want to say both that I think it's a really excellent paper and that I agree with a whole bunch of what Glenn has to say. Maybe because I read the first half of it, it didn't feel like such a whirlwind tour this time as it did the first time I heard this paper. But I'm going to begin by piling on, okay, because I think Glenn's essentially correct. I am disturbed by what I experience in the church these days as a retreat to testimony, that when people are questioned, when anything gets difficult, I actually go out with the missionaries sometimes. I'm one of the people that Glenn refers to as a fully engaged member of the church. Currently I'm my ward choir director, but I have been the gospel doctrine teacher. I've taught seminary. I do all those things, and I love the church. I have, you know, if you ask me what I actually believe, and some people do, then it gets a little more complicated. But
or perhaps simpler.
I feel like we do a huge disservice to ourselves, but much more than that. When anything gets complicated and you say you're just supposed to, and I think a missionary is almost taught to do this, to bear their testimonies and let that be the answer, I believe that it's an abdication of moral responsibility, that that there's an ethical obligation to actually consider questions. When I was a missionary, we called the things that the conversations we had with people discussions. And if you are in a discussion, you have an obligation to listen to the other person and to try to give actual answers. And it's deceptive to say I'm having a discussion and then just bear your testimony and not listen. So it might be that we don't know all the answers, but we should not simply retreat to mysticism. We can admit that we don't know everything. I have not actually heard in the Mormon context, except at Sunstone, when the brethren speak, the thinking has been done. I know it's been said. I just never hear it in the church. What I do hear is follow the brethren. So when the brethren speak, the thinking has been done is patently totalitarian. What's the problem with it? Two problems. One is it's antithetical to personal growth. What is the point of life, right? Within Mormon theology, it's to grow, it's to develop, it's to become more like God. To simply submit your moral agency, your thinking, is antithetical to that. We say follow the brethren, which is, if I'm not mistaken, very, very close to what Glenn means by the agentic shift. Okay, we say, whatever they say, that's what I'm supposed to do. Okay, a command is given, follow the brethren, it's imperative, to give up your own moral agency. This seems, we have a lot to say about the importance of agency in the church. And that's the agency we're talking about. We're not talking about people getting handcuffs and being thrown in jail. We're talking about people making their own decisions, being responsible for their own behavior and their own beliefs. To criticize pride is to advocate humility. And humility must involve openness. Genuine humility, as Glenn says, is openness to further light and knowledge. We claim to believe this. Here's a question. Who's the most humble person in the scriptures? Who's the most prideful person in the scriptures? Moses is a great example. I want to think for a second about Job. So if anyone's actually read the book of Job, anybody has actually read all 42 chapters of the book of Job, that's great. That's awesome. It is far and away my favorite book in the scriptures. For me, it's up there with King, just one step below King Lear and Macbeth in terms of the greatness of the literature. But here's a guy who, if you actually read it, you know that he spent most of those 42 chapters railing against God, or when it was his turn to speak. He was angry with God at his treatment. He was completely rebellious. He refused to submit to God's judgment. He was the antithesis of King Benjamin's, humble like a child, willing to submit to anything that God sees fit to inflict upon him. The actual antithesis of that. Was he prideful or what? To me, he's the example, he's the greatest example of humility, because he, although he had all those opinions, he didn't actually reject God. He stayed in the conversation. He was willing to listen. And because he had one of the great epiphanies of all time. He had this real encounter with God speaking to him out of the whirlwind, because he maintained both integrity and humility at the same time. And that's what we're called upon to do. He's the model of humility for me. So, a couple of criticisms of Glenn's paper. One is the general perspective. What is the framework from which a certain kind of faith is being criticized? It is, by and large, utilitarianism. Okay, Glenn is a businessman. He wants results. He wants to get things done in the world. He cares about the effect on society of faith, and he cares about the effect on the quality of the moral judgments that people make. Okay, so he's going to evaluate blind faith in terms of its effects. He criticizes this agentic shift if it leads to errors in moral judgments. In a minute, I'm going to claim that the agentic shift is a sin, nice strong word there, whether or not you ever make a wrong decision as a result of it.
But that's an argument from deontology, right?
Right. So I'm going to argue on completely different grounds. I mean, it's not a consequential issue. It's a fundamental sin to give your agency to somebody else. The utilitarian approach is typical of the of U.S. reasoning in general, American reasoning, and very typical of LDS approach to justifying commandments. Ask a Mormon, why does God give commandments? Why is the word of wisdom right? They'll tell you about health, right? They won't say because God commanded it, okay? And they won't tell you, they might tell you about it maintaining your freedom of action. But mostly they'll tell you the bad consequences of smoking and drinking. They'll tell you the bad consequences of marital infidelity. They'll tell you the bad consequences of everything else rather than just what makes it right. There are other options. You can base judgments on questions of human dignity, on rational consistency, on various ways of thinking about the golden rule. These are different ways of thinking about morality and grounding, and I'd like to see more of those brought in the paper. To me, to give up my moral reasoning is an offense against my dignity as a human being, as a child of God, as a moral agent. It's a contradiction of what makes me human, okay? And that's what's wrong with it. Whether or not I ever make a bad, whether or not the authority to what I'm referring ever is wrong, okay? So are we open to evidence, to thinking, to input? Okay, my response to follow the brethren is I prefer follow the prophet, and I like to think of Joseph Smith. Okay, what made Joseph Smith a great prophet? Okay, he asked questions. He was not willing to accept the received doctrine of his time, and he was willing to look at all kinds of ideas around him of eternal progression, of moral agency, and incorporate them into a system of religion that I believe was inspired, and that his syncretism and synthesism of these things was inspired. But he was, open to all kinds of input in his ways of thinking, and we should follow that prophet. Now, on the other hand, just to give a couple of criticisms, humility does tell us that we need to be open to further light and knowledge. It also militates in favor of less than complete confidence in our own ability to evaluate evidence and input and arguments. Okay, we're supposed to be open to input and arguments, but humility says that, I'm not sure whether, I have to be less than completely confident in my ability to follow an argument and to say whether it's really right or wrong, to evaluate evidence that's presented to me. I'm not always right about everything. Maybe I don't have all the evidence. All the evidence isn't in on a lot of questions. On a lot of them it is, and I think we should not ignore DNA evidence and all that sort of stuff. I think that's real stuff. But there are, things about the eternities and the way the universe works that, we don't understand dark matter and dark energy and a whole bunch of stuff that is really interesting out there. And who knows what all the evidence is, and we don't maybe have access to all of it by the sensory organs that we have and the ways of knowing that we have. And finally, our ability to weigh different forms of evidence, okay? If there is such a thing as spiritual experience and evidence based on that, as I experience their being, how do you weigh that relative to logic, relative to science, relative to these sources of other evidence that you have? We need to maintain humility about our ability to do all of that. Thanks. And I think Glenn is genuine in saying that he's really interested in everybody's questions and inputs and points of view. And I don't know if we have...
Yes, we have about 12 minutes, and I see a lot of thoughtful-looking people out there and a lot of note-taking. So let's start here.
This room seems to have exactly one microphone in it, and for the sake of the recording, if you're willing to come up here, I'll raise the mic, or Glenn will, and we'll put it someplace.
This is wireless, and I used to be a dean, wireless, so I can pass this.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
State your name, please.
My name is Martha Chasum, and I'm from Indiana. My question is, what if the brethren are wrong, and how do you handle this? My husband was, and I guess still is, state patriarch, since patriarchs are never released. In the last 20 years, he hasn't given any blessings because his health, mental and physical, has gone downhill. And the state president has never in that time asked him how he's doing. He's gone up and down the rows in church and shake hands with this person. With Lloyd, he's skipped right over him, gone on to the next, on to the next. He's never asked me how he's doing. And then a few months ago, we had to put him in the nursing home, and his mental facilities went down very, very quickly. And they called me from the nursing home and said, look, this is not just dementia anymore, this is psychosis. And we're trying this and this drug, but he's in very bad shape. And so I knew that the state president had lost his chance. That if you talked to him, he would not understand even who this person was, and so on. So, at the last state conference, I called the state president out. This was public. And I told him he was wrong, he treated Lloyd wrong, and that I was displeased, and that at some point he was going to pay for this. And there were all these people standing around. And he was stunned. And I really believed that, you know, his big sermons about visiting the sick and the poor and the lonely and all of this baloney, I told him, I said, you know, this is what you preach. And in this case, he was known in the state as a very faithful, wonderful person, and there I was telling him he's wrong. And I still believe I was right to say it. Because all these people in the state said once he'd said it, he was right. But he wasn't. He was wrong.
So there are two parts to your question, as I understand it. One is, how should one behave? And the other is, how should one respond internally? That I want to at least address both of those. And I'm just giving my personal reaction. First of all, I'm really sorry. It sounds incredibly painful to go through what you're going through. And I want to say two things. I'm really proud of you for standing up, and I really feel like people in leadership need to hear that they're not always perfect. I don't think it should be done with vitriol, and I don't think it should be done in order to embarrass them, but that part of sustaining people is helping them to do their calling right, and sometimes that requires us to tell them that they're not doing it right. I hope that we find ways of doing that that are genuinely supportive, but we're all human. And that's the other thing I want to say, which is the internal response. I really strongly do not believe that the brethren are always right, whether it's Proposition 8 in California that I was involved in, or whether it's the excommunication of, you know, six people with whom I was on first-name basis and still am and love and treasure as members of the church. And the most Job-like moment I've ever had in my life was around those excommunications and my response to them. And the answer that I got, for what it's worth, and I really feel like I got it, is that that we're all human and that God is doing the best that he can with these people. And that that doesn't mean that we have to just sit up and salute and think that everything they do is right, but that we need to understand that, you know, God's dealing with the same kind of people that we are and that everybody's dealing with, and that we can't expect perfection from our church leaders. We should not, I still maintain what I said before, we should give them real feedback and all of that, but that human imperfections in leaders are just to be expected, and God can't do that much better. Part of the message of the book of Job toward the end, in my view, is what Joseph Smith would say about it, that God did not create the universe out of nothing, and there's only so much he can do with it, and there's only so much that he can do with humans. Okay, that's really getting theological, and it's a long discussion there.
About five more minutes.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Here.
Oh, Glenn?
Yes.
Please go, Pat. Please.
Thank you. My name's Bill McGee, and I live here in Alpine. An observation and a question is that, you know, in the early church, people were actually participants, right? There was an actual this opportunity. It was my church, and I got to participate. I mean,
common consent meant something.
Right. Yeah, I could. When Joseph Smith wants to get rid of Sidney Rigdon, I can vote no, and he has to keep him, right?
Right.
And that's probably the most glaring example of that kind of thing. And there's been this shift, clearly, right, beginning with probably correlation, where this move from this common consent to the corporatization of the church, and when you create that kind of thing, then there's real resistance to any kind of upward communication. The result has been, and someone else said this better, that we're self-correlating. We've gotten to the point where the church doesn't correlate us anymore. We self-correlate. And how do you interact in that environment? I mean, the little community I live in is highly normative. I'm fortunate there's a handful of people who kind of think outside the box a little bit. But that box seems getting smaller, and it's very difficult to interact in a way that's meaningful. And so my experience is becoming less and less important.
Thanks.
Yeah, well, I sort of changed my box. In more ways than one, I suppose. But I had, for the last several years, I've had something. When I was finishing school in Ann Arbor, I had a group of people with whom we met. That was great. We had our own little men's existential crisis club. We met at the Church Institute. They knew what we were doing. They knew what we were talking about. There really wasn't that much of a problem with it. Since I moved to Palo Alto, years later, we had great groups. Kim McCall, Todd and Laura Compton, and people just get together. It's, you know, outside the church, but we're handling issues of ethics, theology, our relationship to whatever form of God we believe in, the church and so forth. We're handling that on a very open basis without, you know, worrying about it running crosswise of what was correlated for discussion that week. Kim, you've been at this a long time.
I completely agree with what you say. I'm distressed by I think it started before correlation, but I'm distressed by the self-regulation and the submission, the sense that, you know, we're just supposed to salute. And I think that it weakens, it saps life out of the church. I think that we all have so much we can bring that is not welcome, and it's not invited. And it I'm looking for a better word than saps life out of it. It changes a color picture to a black and white picture, and I miss it.
Okay, I sense two more questions. The gentleman in red, did you have a question? Okay, maybe one more, and we're.
Correct. Thank you. I'm just looking at my notes here, and I think I have a question or two that can spring from them. They come from your comment, Kim. The common quote, when the brethren have spoken, the thinking has been done. And I'm reflecting upon the different types of organizations that our community has. We have corporate America, which is very top down. In that case, when the president has spoken, all the worker bees respond accordingly. And that, we say that's what makes a good corporation.
Some do, some don't. But I'll get to that, actually.
On the other extreme, we have some very flat organizations, and I'm going to draw from the Quaker tradition as a good example of no hierarchy. So now we have our church, and where is it positioned from the extreme left and right on the scale that I've created? And it has some qualities of both. On the flat side, we speak of personal revelation. It wants to tend in the Quaker direction. But on the corporate side, it's very top-down. So sometimes I think we, the church, the brethren, constantly are changing hats as they move along the scale, and that is a place for confusion. Another thing I tend to hear from people in CES and leaders in the church, middle people, middle leaders, they're told not to, quote, pit the brethren against one another. So here's my question. Do you see a way to be to have a supportive attitude of the brethren, meaning the form of the 12? Their calling, their mantle, while you and I also go about our own path, our own interpretation of correctness, doing what we wish to do while giving respect to them, even though our actions might be quite different than what they would do. The Prop 8 California issue may well be a good example.
Let me speak to the issue of hierarchical structure first. I addressed this somewhat in some earlier Sunstone papers, but I actually worked as a management consultant for a number of years and still do some consulting, and, you know, some organizational structure. And one of the things that comes out of complexity science and has percolated well into management consultancy and a lot of organizational practice has been the idea that as problems become more complex and more dynamic, the search for solution is much better done in an organization that has a much more flat group of fairly autonomous operators that communicate with each other and communication goes up and down, as opposed to a centrally controlled situation where there is mainly a centralized pronouncement going down and that's it, thank you very much. So the church, in my mind, it's kicked correlation into much higher gear. It has certainly suppressed civil discourse. It has certainly made the place much more hierarchical than it was, say, in 1979, when I'm sitting in the honors reading room at BYU. I look up and I see this little poster that says, if you think all the big questions have been answered for you, then Sunstone probably isn't for you. And for Sunstone. And I was 19, you know, getting ready for my mission. I thought, what a nice thought. You know, I think all the important questions have been answered for me, but the idea of searching for something more is really great. You know, and I think a bit differently now that I'm 50. But the issue of corporate America accepting rigid hierarchy is actually decreasingly the norm. And the church has, if anything, fallen well behind practices in the best performing corporations. The church maybe doesn't have a lot of choice if it's dealing with modernity, because modernity, again, goes against most organized religions that look for a basis in historicity. I'll let Kim talk to the second bit.
just on the first bit, I mean, there's this concept of open door policies that is really important in well-functioning corporations, that you get to go a couple levels up and make suggestions and talk about the way things are working. And my current state presidency is really open to input from us hoi polloi. But let me tell you something that Orson Scott Card, an analogy he made. So a human body or most bodies composed of both skeletons and muscles. And imagine a body without a skeleton, with all these muscles pulling, it doesn't get anything done. And a skeleton without any muscles doesn't get anything done. And I actually buy this, that part of the role of the structure of the church hierarchy is it's the church is very powerful and effective because it's really organized, and those people I'm the muscle, okay, I try to get things done, but without a structure and the function of the skeleton, my actions don't go very far. Now that's not a prescription for action, but it's a prescription for feeling a little better about the fact that there are a bunch of stodgy people, or, you know, very rigid people, because it actually helps get work done in a whole lot of ways. And but it also emphasizes something that I feel, which is that it is really our job to be active, to be creative, to even if it's not particularly welcome, to to be making gospel doctrine class interesting, and to be out there. You know, my ward loves me, okay, and you know, everybody knows that I respect the bishop, but I don't always defer or something like that. By giving really interesting lessons, or by writing music for my choir and doing really interesting things, I make the experience of my ward much more interesting for everybody else. and that's my job, and that's your job, is to it's not to just salute, but to make the world as interesting and effective as possible. And we're out of time.
Yes, I am so sorry to have to stop this, because I think it's been very interesting. Maybe you can continue the questions or conversation out in the hall. And I want to thank the two presenters today for a great save at the beginning.
Thank you.